phase of our evening. Talk on Bhagavad Gita, Yoga and Consciousness Expansion. A brief note about our speaker. His Holiness Bhanu Swami Maharaj is one of the senior disciples of His Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, founder Acharya of ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He holds a B.A. degree in Oriental Fine Arts History from the University of British Columbia. He joined the Hare Krishna movement in India in 1970. Initiated in 1971 by Srila Prabhupada, he took sannyasa oaths in 1984. Bhanu Swami was personally instructed in the art of deity worship by Srila Prabhupada, and within ISKCON, he became an authority on the topic. A scholar in Sanskrit and Bengali, Bhanu Swami has translated 15 significant works of Gaudiya Vaishnava Kanam, with 6 more titles in progress. Many of these works are commentaries from primary members of the Gaudiya Sampradaya on the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Ishopanishad and Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhanu Swami is a quiet achiever and has studied a variety of disciplines including martial arts, Reiki healing, Carnatic music, specifically Veena. He is a reputed astrologer. His current efforts in spreading Krishna consciousness includes completing the construction of a temple in Chennai and establishing the new temple in Tokyo. Bhanu Swami's depth of scholarship has enabled him to create presentations on topics like karma, reincarnation, yoga and Srimad Bhagavatam. And he presents these as he travels to select parts of the world and winning those he meets with heartfelt spiritual intellectualism. He continues with his translation service to this day, giving us the nectar from the Bengali and Sanskrit works of the previous Vaishnava Acharyas to enhance our understanding of the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. He is also a member of Governing Body Commission of ISKCON since 2003. His GBC committee responsibilities include past chairmanship and currently participation in the Parallel Lines of Authority Committee for the Strategic Planning Initiative. He is a great inspiration for many devotees around the world, and he preaches Krishna consciousness in Japan, Malaysia, Russia, and India. May I now request Swamiji to please take on the dais. Request Brother Arad Padmanabhan to accompany the guest and honor the guest, please. Request Brother Padmanabhan to honor. Lila Ki Rao, chief coordinator of ISKCON Chennai.
Hare Krishna. So, as we live in this world, we often observe many things. And as we see in India, since time immemorial, the great sages have been wondering about the universe. Where are we? What is this universe? What is our action within this universe? And similarly, in the modern world also, we have people wondering about why we exist, and etc. But a lot of the curiosity has been channeled into science. And instead of sages and others looking at the sky and wondering about the stars and the planets, we have scientists doing that in the modern world with their advanced telescopes, whatever. Some time ago, they sent up the Hubble telescope, which is special because it is beyond the atmosphere of the Earth. And if we're within the atmosphere creates some obstacle, so the images are not so clear. And if we have a telescope that is beyond the atmosphere, then we'll get very clear images. So this telescope was put into space, and then it could observe all of the configurations within the sky and then send the messages back to Earth to make images here, which are very clear. And the idea was to give us a clearer idea about this universe, because scientists are also curious about how big the universe is and what is the universe made of. So, to the astonishment of the scientists at that time, when the pictures came back, they found that what were supposed to be stars in the sky, even with their telescopes that they had on Earth, were not stars at all, but actually they were groups of, they were galaxies with hundreds and millions of stars within each of these little spots in the sky. So scientists became very astonished that suddenly they understood that the universe is much bigger than they had thought it was, even though they had made some calculations by physics on the size of the universe. So they observed all of these bodies in the sky, which were little dots, but when they used the telescope, then they found that actually they were galaxies with billions of suns within and millions of planets, etc. So this opened the eyes of scientists to understand that our knowledge actually is quite limited, and if we have some more instruments, we can get a greater understanding of the size of the universe, at least. And of course, when they understood the size of the universe and the number of stars and planets within it, they also understood that there must be life in other parts of the universe, definitely, because there were so many possibilities. This is just a rough estimate of the size of the universe according to modern science. Probably not correct, but it's a big number, and we probably can't even conceive of how big that is. It's so big. And most of it is space, and within that space we got these little dots called stars, which have turned into galaxies, and within the galaxies then we got millions of stars with huge amounts of space in between them also. So, and then, of course, we got so many of these all over the place. Then we have, of course, our own Earth, which is in one of these galaxies also. So we're, one of these huge galaxies with millions of stars in it, and our little sun is there, situated someplace there with planets rotating around the sun. This, at least, our modern conception of what everything is. And on this Earth, then we have various countries, etc., and then each little individual's living in this, his little house in this country someplace. And we are very small beings within this huge universe. And of course, what the Hubble telescope did, it gave us some idea about the universe, not complete, because even that telescope cannot see everything. So in other words, we are in this universe, we're very small particles within this universe. But at the same time, we're very conscious, and we can be aware of the size of this universe. So that's the realization of modern science. Now, in ancient times, of course, also, they were thinking about this. And if you look in the different scriptures, not only the scriptures of India, the Vedas, but if you look in the Buddhist scriptures and even the Jain scriptures, you'll find that we're also trying to figure out what the universe was. A little bit different. This is a Buddhist description of the universe here. Illustration. Of course, illustrations are two-dimensional or whatever, so a little difficult for us to understand them. And they're also somewhat symbolic. But here we have a very common idea of the universe. In the center there is this strange thing, which is called Mount Meru, which is like an inverted mountain. And then there's various islands and oceans in circles around this. So this is a very common theme we'll find. And of course it's represented in the yantras and the mandalas that we find in Buddhism and also in India as well. And we find this theme coming up on many, many places. And from this we understand that the conception of the universe is something very symmetrical. So we have circles and squares and exact dimensions. And if we look at the Srimad Bhagavatam, there we'll find that the dimensions are actually exactly calculated, so that everything turns out to be very symmetrical, either in terms of, you know, distances and circles and whatever like that. And one theme, again, is this lotus we see here, the Sri Yantra. And again, we find the petals of a lotus here in various places around it. And in the Bhagavatam as well, we'll find that the description of the central island is like a lotus also. So we have an image of a lotus. This is a Jain representation of the universe also. So a common theme of a symmetrical universe with a central structure in it called Mount Meru. And even in the temples, we'll find that this is represented. This is Angkor Wat in Cambodia, a very symmetrical temple with a central tower in it and then expanding squares around it. And it's said to represent the universe with Meru in the middle, the central axis in the middle, again. So, and of course, we find that the temples in India are also basically the same figure again. So, not only in the mandala we find this, but we find this within in the universe, we find with the galaxies, and we find it within plants itself, very symmetrically somehow designed. And actually, you can take the measurements, and you'll find that they're actually, they go very by mathematical formula, actually, the symmetry by which flowers and things are formed and how the petals are formed, very, very exactly. So, in other words, the ancient sages of India had envisaged a very symmetrical universe, a harmonious universe, based on some very steady mathematical principles, if we call it that in the modern world, like that. And of course, in the Western world also, they've also been striving to bring some harmony into the world of chaos. So we find different artists trying to figure out the human body in terms of harmony as well. And of course, we have Bharatanatyam and other things in India like that also, dealing with the grace of the human body. So that's observing the external world and trying to make sense of the external world by giving it some sort of form and symmetry. But where did all this knowledge come from? How did the yogis and the sages get this information about a symmetrical universe or whatever? So actually, the main knowledge was not external, but was internal. They looked inside. And this is how they developed their vision of the reality of the inner and external world. So the word yoga itself means, it comes from the verb yuj, which means to join together or to unify, to bring together. So what does yoga do? In its broadest sense, it brings together the whole universe, the body, the mind, and the soul into one big unit. Somehow there's a unity between all of these things, the individual, small individual, and the whole universe. However, there's controversy about what yoga is. And particularly in the modern world, there's a little, rather distorted view of yoga. We'll find that it's very popular in the world. They have various organizations practicing yoga, and in the Western world, very popular also. And all the gyms have yoga in them also. So is it simply a physical exercise, which it becomes when you put it in the gym? Is it gymnastics? We'll find that these people, they can do very fantastic movements with their body, bending their body this way and that way, etc. Is it some sadhana or method of developing psychic abilities? Some people are into psychic abilities, etc. So is it for paranormal development, or is it simply austerity? We see many people in the Himalayas, they're sitting in caves and they come down in the Kumbh Mela and Allahabad, and then they're doing many types of austere activities there. So is it austerity, or what is it actually? And can anybody do yoga? Is everybody qualified for yoga? So in the modern world, we even have yoga for dogs. And they call it doga. So can animals do yoga also? Or can cats do yoga? So we should actually go to some authority. We can use these words like yoga, etc., or bhakti, or jnana, or atma. But we should base our usage of the words on authority, on scriptures. So if we go to yoga, one of the earliest authorities in yoga was Patanjali. And he wrote the Yoga Sutras. And in there, he describes that yoga has eight limbs, astanga. Anga means limb and asta means eight, so it's eight stages, which are all very important to follow if you want to perfect yoga, as explained by Patanjali. So the first ones are quite straightforward. We have yama and niyama, asana and pranayama. Now, normally now in the modern world, they think of asana and pranayama as yoga. But there's two previous elements. That's the yama and the niyama. That is restraints, things you shouldn't do and things you should do. So we have the restraints. No violence, no lying, no theft, no sex life, no hoarding. These are things you shouldn't do. These will disturb your practice of yoga. So these are preliminaries in order that the asana and the pranayama and later stages can give good results. And then we have niyama, the things you should do. Cleanliness, satisfaction, austerity, study of scriptures, worship of God. That's called niyama, things we should do. So there's things we shouldn't do, things we should do. These are preliminaries to practice yoga. So in other words, it involves certain, it's a conduct of, let's say, behavior. Things in our daily life that we have to do in order to reach perfection in yoga. Then we do asanas, or various postures, which are quite famous in the modern world, like the Padmasana or the Cobra Asana, etc. So many different asanas are there. Ultimately, the whole purpose of the asana, or the posture, is to sit properly. And the whole purpose of sitting properly is so you can meditate. You can concentrate the mind. So there's a certain process of sitting so that you can aid your concentration of mind or your meditation process. And along with that, we have pranayama, which literally means control of the breath or the prana. So the yogis discovered that if you control the breathing, you can control the mind. If you can regulate the breathing, then automatically the mind becomes peaceful. So pranayama is a type of practice that helps with the control of the mind. So these we can say are physical things to do with the body. And then we start concentrating on the mind, pratyahara, which means withdrawal. So we try to withdraw our mind from thinking of external objects in this world. And then dharana, we begin to concentrate the mind internally. And then jhana means constant concentration. Without effort, we can concentrate or meditate. And we don't have external thoughts and distractions. And then the eighth stage is called samadhi, or the trance stage, where we're completely unaware of anything in the external world. And all thoughts of anything in this world cease. And then what happens? We realize Atma, the soul. So these last stages we see are concerning the mind and then the soul. And the first stages are the body. So this is Patanjali's system here. And we find in between the body and the soul, we got the mind as some sort of bridge to help us realize the soul. The body cannot realize the soul, but the mind can be a mechanism to realize the soul. However, the mind cannot really realize the soul because mind is material, soul is spiritual. So a material thing cannot realize a spiritual thing. So actually it's the soul that realizes itself. It is self-aware. But to reach that stage, we have to cancel out the body and we have to stop the mind completely. Yeah. So at the very beginning of the Yoga Sutras, it is said, yoga means stopping all actions of material consciousness. So we stop all the thoughts, we stop all the conceptions in our mind completely. When that stops, then the Atma is allowed to reveal itself. And the very last sutra, liberation is freedom from material qualities and material goals. Liberation is establishment of the self in its spiritual nature. So, in other words, the whole goal of this yoga is not physical at all, though in the modern world we emphasize the asanas, etc. The actual goal is Atma, or the self, which is completely opposite of the body. And when we realize that self, we become very peaceful and we get a state of liberation, which means we're free from the body and we're no longer subject to birth and death. So involved in this explanation of Patanjali, we have a gross physical body, and with that you do your asanas. And then we got your sukshma sarir, with your mind, intelligence, and ego. And with that mind, then you start the process of meditation and pratyahara, dharana, and jhana. And then you stop all your thought processes. And then the third real element in the body is the self, or the Atma. This is the spiritual element. So this is what you realize, or what it realizes itself, we can say, at this point. And it's completely separate from the other two sections. And both the other ones are material. We have this gross material body here, and then we got our subtle material body. That's the mind, etc. It's also material. It's not spiritual. It cannot think on its own. It cannot, just like a computer doesn't do anything on its own. We have to operate it. Okay. So that subtle body we cannot see, but many of the yogis describe it. Here's a diagram of all the subtle currents in the body, the nadis, etc., which are not nerves and muscles, etc., but they're subtle pranic currents in the body, useful for the yogi and also useful in medicine. And of course we have the chakras also described in the yoga literature. These are, we can say, energy centers within the subtle body. So you cannot see these chakras, but they're there. We cannot see with these eyes. They control certain functions in the subtle body. And because the subtle body is related to the gross body, they also influence the gross body on various levels in various parts of the body. So I won't go into that in detail, but there's just these chakras here. And they're illustrated in various diagrams of yoga, quite famous. At the bottom, we have the Muladhara chakra. Then we have the Svadhisthana chakra. And we have the Manipuraka chakra. And they all have bijas, or syllables, that stimulate those chakras as well, we see here. different syllables for each one, like lum here and vum here for the second chakra, and rum for the third chakra near the navel, yum for the heart chakra, which is the love chakra. And as you're doing here, you're meditating on the heart and the idea of love. So it's a love chakra. Here we have throat chakra, responsibility, communications, speaking, etc. And hum is the syllable. And the very famous one, and it's called the third eye, the Ajna chakra, right in the middle of your forehead, for conceptualization and our view of the world. And the top of the head, we have the Sahasrara, or the spiritual chakra, the thousand-petal lotus. So though we cannot see these things with our normal eyes, there are some people in the modern world who claim to see the chakras. So you can develop special eyes, even if you're not so spiritual. This is a diagram made by somebody in America who was doing some alternative therapy like massage and things like this. And then at a certain point, she would look at bodies and she would see these little thingies on people spinning around, which are the chakras. Chakra means a wheel. And what do wheels do? They spin. So she saw these things, circles moving on people's bodies. And this is what she drew, not only on the front, but on the back. The chakras were there, spinning around at different speeds. And of course, they have different colors to, we could say, illustrate the frequencies and the energy content of these different chakras. So she would see these things, actually, with a different type of vision, using these eyes, but on a different level. So ultimately, she found that subtle body is a material body, but it's real. And it's very complex. Just as this physical body is very complex for us, even medical science cannot really explain everything about this physical body and its organs. So there's another body, the sukshma sarir, or the subtle body, which is also very, very complex. It's got the chakras in it, and it's got these various layers, more and more subtle layers, up to these 7 layers or 9 layers in it, and they all have chakras on them, on subtler and subtler levels. So it's a very complex system that is accompanying you everywhere, wherever you go, when you're waking and sleeping, when you're meditating, etc. The subtle body is also there. And of course, within that subtle body, we have not only the chakras, etc., but we also have your mind functioning, your intelligence, your sense of identity, your false ego, etc., is also there. So we see that the mind actually is a very strong thing. My mind in general, with this whole subtle body, with the intelligence and the ego and the mental thing, memory powers, etc., concentration, all this is what we call mind. So mind is actually a very powerful thing, which we don't really think is an object, but actually it is, according to the Vedic literature. It's very powerful, and it's due to the mind that we've developed civilizations, we build things, we create things, etc. And of course, also very dangerous, because using our mind, we invent weapons by which we kill each other, which animals don't do. They defend themselves, but they don't wipe out their own species like we do. Like in the First and Second World Wars, like 40 million people killed deliberately by other human beings. Why? Because we have modern weapons and this. And so mind is also dangerous, very, very dangerous. So what is this mind? So some, maybe accidentally even, science itself has stumbled on the fact that mind is real. It's not an abstraction, something just your brain waves are there and your neurons are firing. No, it's actually something very, very powerful and very real. Hal Puthoff was a PhD in Stanford Research Institute, and he was commissioned to investigate paranormal activity. Is it real or not real? Because some people have claimed they have these far-out abilities, and then some people are cheating. They don't really have those abilities. They're using some trick by which they can do things, whatever like that. So he was assigned to investigate, is this paranormal ability real or not? And he was a physicist, a scientist, and so he designed experiments which would eliminate the possibility of cheating, etc., in many ways. And he chose one clairvoyant, Ingo Swann, here you see in the picture, American, who somehow had these powers from birth by which he could, relax and then travel in his mind and get information and bring it back. That was his main talent. So Hal Puthoff, he investigated and did many, many experiments with this Ingo Swann. And then at the conclusion of all this, he admitted that the powers are real. And they're also in everybody. The mind is very, very, it's something we don't know about. It's got a lot of potential in it. And it's not just stuck here now, but it can extend itself out. It can get information. It can go into the future. It can go into the past. It can do many things. So he concluded that the mind is a real thing. Despite the ambiguities inherent in the type of exploration covered in these programs, the integrated results appear to provide unequivocal evidence of a human capacity to access events remote in space and time, however, falteringly by some cognitive process not yet understood. So now the ability of Ingo Swann was real. He could do things that we normally don't expect a person to do. My years of involvement as a research manager in these programs have left me with the conviction that this fact must be taken into account in any attempt to develop an unbiased picture of the structure of reality. So I say that the mind and its powers are real. This is one example. He was given a number, Ingo Swann, and then according to that number, he had to say, okay, what does it represent? That's all, a number, a random number. Actually, the number was on an envelope, and in the envelope there were some photographs. So then he had to, okay, what does this number represent? So he drew these pictures at the top. One was a map, the other is a machine. As it turned out, the photographs were actually aerial photographs taken from a satellite, an American satellite, over Siberia. And nobody knew about this because it was military and secret. So the photographs were secret, they were not public knowledge at all, and they had just recently been taken a few days before, and then they were put in the envelope. So there's no way that Ingo Swann could know what was in the envelope, because it was secret even from most of the military. And he couldn't go there, obviously, to Russia or whatever. He didn't know about Russia at all. But he drew these two pictures, and then they compared it with the actual what was there, and the map turned out to be very accurate, about 85% accurate map he drew of the place. And this machine, which is the machine you see in the bottom here, that thing, which was actually used to move a submarine, a nuclear submarine, along the tracks. It was a military installation in Russia, and they're secretly building a submarine. So he drew this just in a few seconds by getting a number. So that was the power of his mind. So there are other persons also who did experiments like this. This is one thing, Robert John, Princeton University. His idea was to see if people could move objects with their mind, because there's a few famous people, particularly in Russia. There was one woman who could move objects across the table with her mind. So he wanted to know, well, can normal people move objects with their mind also, which would prove that mind actually has a physical force behind it. It's a real thing with force. So one of the experiments was these balls here. You press a button, the ball will fall down, and it can go left or right. And it's level surface. So by law of chance, you press it 1,000 times, you get 500 going one way, 500 going left, 500 go right. That's all. So the idea was, instead of left, right, you make them go to the right. Or make them go to the left, one or the other. So you concentrate, go to the right, go to the right, go to the right, and you press it 1,000 times, and you see it more go to the right. Maybe you get 580 going to the right and less going to the left line. And they did it. And he found out, yes, over long trials, it did operate according to the, go to the right or go to the left according to the mind of the individuals. So then he concluded, somehow consciousness could influence matter, and you could do it over space and time. So you could do the experiment in New York and have the person thinking in London get the same result over space. And then you could do over time. You could be in London and 1 week ahead of time, before the experiment, you could think of pressing it and you could get the same effect. So space and time had no influence on how the mind could operate in relation to the experiment. Very strange. Yeah. So then the people like this concluded that, yes, the mind has some powers, which we formerly read about with yogis and mystics having. So they said, powers must be real in the mind. I don't have so much darn sure. Anyway, China also, research is done. There's yogis in China, Qigong masters, etc., who have great powers as well. So various peoples have studied that. There's this German who was studying about this in the effect in China. And there's several people there who do experiments like this. One is to combine hydrogen and carbon monoxide to make carbon dioxide, which you normally cannot do unless you have high degree of 30 atmospheres pressure and 300 degrees Celsius. Then you can combine it, so you have to seal it up. So the idea was that the person, the Chinese yogi, had to combine it with his mind. So he actually succeeded in doing that at a distance, but they had to seal up the two gases in a special metal container because otherwise it would burst. And when he did that, he was able, with his mind, to combine the two elements and come up with carbon dioxide, just with the mind. So very, very powerful again. this is, I don't know, maybe it's legendary, whether it's actual fact or not, I don't know. But there's another person in China who was very remarkable, and he was studied by 30 scientists. And in one occasion, he moved a 100-pound sack of sugar through a wall with his mind. Matter moving through matter, which is impossible normally. Another experiment, they put a bug in a sealed jar, glass thing, and with his mind, he got the bug out. How did the bug get out? Did he reconstitute the bug like this from one place to the other or whatever? They were a little curious about that, so what they did was they got a camera that goes like 200 frames a second or something, very, very fast camera. And then they did an experiment. And in three frames, they found the bug passing through the glass. He somehow was able to pull it through the glass wall. How? We don't know. And he did that with his mind. So these are some of the illustrations of the fact that the mind is more mysterious and more powerful than we think it is. And it can do a lot of marvelous things. Now, these are special people, but then again, we have experiments to show that even common people can do this. So the Ingo Swan, who was and Hal Puthoff in that experiment, through that, they developed programs by which common people could also develop such abilities. Not to the extent of Ingo Swan, but at least something they could, use the same technique, and they could figure out, objects like this at a distance, etc. So there's special training, and then you get these effects. So we all have some potential in our mind to do this thing beyond time and space. So this is not surprising, because we see in Bhagavad Gita that one of the first things that Krishna mentions when he's speaking to Arjuna is the power of the mind. Very, very powerful. So he says here that one must deliver himself with the help of his mind, not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and its enemy as well. So this is not speaking of the mystic powers of the mind, but the power of the mind in conducting our life and in establishing a goal in our life. If we don't control the mind, mind is the enemy and it degrades us and we cannot advance. If we control the mind, then we can elevate ourselves and reach our goal. So in other words, the mind is very, very powerful. Later on in chapter 8 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his present body, in his next life he will attain that state without fail. So whatever you think of when you die will influence your next body. So there's a very famous story in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There was one king, Bharat, who retired from being a king, and he started practicing monastic life in the Himalayas near the Gandaki River in Nepal. And at a certain stage, he became attracted to a small deer without a mother, and he began caring for the deer. And then he died. And as he was dying, he was thinking of the baby deer and how it needed to be protected, which is natural because he was affectionate for the deer. So in his next lifetime, he became a deer. Why? Because he was thinking of a deer when he was died. So now, of course, in India, we see this is quite common when people are dying. We're trying to get them to think of good things, not bad things. And we tell them to chant the name of Balaji or Vishnu or something like that instead of thinking of material things. Because people understand that what you think of when you die does have some effect upon your next body. However, maybe we doubt this is stories or whatever like that. However, in the modern world again, in science itself, there is some, we can say, proof, indirect proof, but some proof that what was stated here, that what you think of when you die, you attain that in your next lifetime, is true. This comes from investigation of Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was a psychiatrist in America, who got interested in children who think of, when they're small, they recollect a previous life. I was so-and-so, and you know, I was doing this as my life, and they describe all sorts of events from a previous life. And then this doctor was saying, well, how do they think like this? Why, is it fake, and somebody's putting the things in their head? Or is it some spontaneous thing that happens to most children or whatever? So he investigated about thousands of cases of this, personally investigating. Not because he was theistic or was religious, because like, he said, I'm an atheist. But he was very curious, why do children think like this, whatever. So he methodically investigated so many cases of this, and then through that, then his conclusion was, it's not fake, they actually have recollections. So what his conclusion is that they must have had a previous lifetime, and now they're in this lifetime, and they can remember their previous experiences. In other words, we go from body to body. That was his conclusion. As Bhagavad Gita says, you go from body to body. So this was Dr. Ian Stevenson's conclusion, that the children really have experiences like this. But in the process of doing that, then he discovered something else. And that is that in many cases, these children remember their death. And it was not, sometimes it was not a particularly good death. It was an accidental death or whatever, or they got shot or something like that. And the wounds inflicted when they died got reflected in their next body when they were born and stayed with them as wounds or birthmarks, etc. So this is one case here of a boy in India. He remembered his previous lifetime in a different village about 100 miles away and gave the details of his family and his wife and the house, etc. They investigated. It was true. But then, how did he die? He was shot in the chest by a shotgun. And a shotgun has many bullets in it. So his this is the diagram here. The police autopsy was there, and there was this was the diagram from the policeman that drew, with many bullet hole wounds in his chest and one big one in the middle. That was previous lifetime. When he was born, it was a little strange because he had these white marks on his chest, and I didn't know what they were. They didn't go away. And then when he was about 4 years old, he began speaking about previous lifetime, etc., like that. But when you compare the marks in the bullet hole wounds and the marks on his chest, same pattern is there. So not one case, but many cases like that. In cases where someone got their ear blown off by a gun in one lifetime, next year, born without an ear. Another one, someone's fingers chopped off one lifetime, they bled to death. Next lifetime, no fingers. No genetic reason, it's no fingers. So in other words, the trauma of dying with a certain wound in the body pressed itself into the next body, and they got that same deformity in their next lifetime, which shows how powerful the mind can be. If we've got that image in our mind of death, it gets stuck in our next body. Yeah? That's just one other example of the, we could say, the proof of the that what you think of when you die, you attain. Okay, so the Bhagavad Gita also describes how the mind is powerful, and it's also a source of our limitation because we have desires in the mind and we have karma there, and very, very difficult to control the mind, which will make us degrade ourselves. As a strong wind sweeps away a boat on the water, even one of the roaming senses in which the mind focuses can carry away a man's intelligence. So mind can go astray very, very easily. So this is a problem. And Arjuna says, that's very difficult to control the mind. I cannot be a yogi. But Krishna says, O mighty armed son of Kunti, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and detachment. So you've got to practice controlling the mind. So that's why we have various sadhanas, to control the mind. So there is also a hierarchy here. We have the working senses. We have matter, and then the senses which observe the matter and get pulled along with it. And higher than the senses, we have the mind. Higher than the mind is the intelligence. So the intelligence can control the mind, or should control the mind. And higher than the intelligence is the soul. Like that. So we have the gross body on the bottom, then we have the subtle body which can control the gross body, and then we have the soul behind that. That's the actual position. So the soul is superior to the subtle body superior to the gross body. Unfortunately, this doesn't always work, because the intelligence also, it becomes subservient to the mind. And then we don't control the mind at all. The mind and the senses go off wherever they want to, and the intelligence acts as the servant of the senses and the mind. So this is a problem. However, if we get the soul involved, then we can solve the problem. Okay, by ceasing engagements, by experiencing the higher taste, he is fixing consciousness. So we get the higher taste of the soul, then the intelligence will control the mind will control the senses. So we have to get that higher spiritual experience, develop that spiritual taste somehow or other. This may be a little difficult for people to appreciate, but at least in our common life, we should somehow utilize the mind so that we can get very good results. Not everyone can be a yogi and go to the Himalayas and stop the functions of the mind and realize Atma. But with a little bit of that spiritual taste, we can begin to use the mind in a very positive way. So we have some practical things we can do with the mind. One is we should realize the mind has choices. It's not that we have to do this or we like this. It could do either this, 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 or this. And there's always choice for the mind. So we have to change the habit of the mind. Usually it doesn't choose, it goes in one direction. So we have to realize that we do have a choice. And before we do things, carefully consider. The other is that the mind also is very powerful to create goals and help us achieve those goals. It can select the goals, it can also help us achieve the goals. As I said, whatever you think of when you die, you attain some. Mind is very powerful. So if we have to choose the right goal, then we can attain it. So we have to change the habit of the mind. Generally, I say we don't choose properly. Rather, we're controlled by the mind. The mind just goes off, like the boat in the water. So stimuli are there, and then response is there. Between the stimulus coming into us and our response, there's choice. But as I said, generally we don't do that. Stimulus comes in, and we act according to a certain habit, and there's no choice involved at all. We have the stimulus, we got the action, etc. In between them, there should be some thought before we do the action. Trying to do that one. So we must become responsible for our choices and for our lives ultimately. So the mind can help us in doing that. So as I said, we have habits in the mind. Unfortunately, we are affected by our conditions, and then we simply react to that situation with a certain habit. But we should actually base our behavior upon decision, not upon the conditions we're in. We have to subordinate our feelings to inner values. Then we have freedom to choose. The opposite of the person who can choose properly is the reactive person. He is driven by feelings and circumstances. in a certain circumstance, he gets a certain feeling, then he acts in a certain way. And he says, I couldn't help it. So he has no choice. But it's actually a habit that he's developed. And whenever you get the same circumstance, you get the same feeling, and you get the same action. So he's controlled by the circumstance, ultimately. And if we're controlled by the circumstance, we don't want to change, then nothing will happen. We can't set proper goals. We're rather hopeless. No control over life. So the opposite of the reactive person is the proactive person. So his actions are based upon carefully considered integral values. Very strong internal values. And this is the basis of change. So we cannot impose values from outside. People will tell you this. These are external. To a certain extent, we may follow out of duty or fear. As the government says, do this, do this, do this. If you don't do this, you get thrown in jail. So we have external values imposed on us. The real values come internally, something that we've experienced, something very, very inside ourselves. Ultimately, it means something that comes from the Atma, from the soul. Have a higher taste that will govern all of our external activities. So it should be a profound value. So which goals? We should control the mind, and then we should set our goals, yes? Normally, we have the regular goals in life. These are common things, nothing special about them. These are the goals and of the individual and society and family, etc. So we have everyone gets married, everyone has family, everyone needs money, everyone needs work. And these are we spend a lot of time on this. Probably 80% of our life on all these things, on these first things. And then we get possessions for ourselves and our family. And then as a relief, we get some pleasure. Yeah. And additionally, we have friends and enemies like that. So these are the common centers of our life. These are our common goals. So nothing extraordinary about that. Everybody in the whole world has these goals. What about the soul? Generally, nobody thinks about the soul. It's out of the picture completely. And that's the most important thing. That's the you. That's the person. But we're not even thinking about that in our life. So something is wrong. So this is part of the internal goal. We have to first understand who I am. I'm not the body. I'm something else. This is Krishna's first teaching. You're not the body. You're the soul. So who am I? What are my real needs and desires? What will really satisfy me? What is my real nature? What are my true qualities? What are the principles by which I live? So we have to start thinking internally and be very introspective. Out of that, if we come to the idea that we have a central part of ourself that doesn't change, something which is eternal, that is the Atma, then this solves our problem. If we have the internal Atma, we have guidance. We don't have to go to other people to ask what to do. We have security because we understand we're something which is eternal, not something temporary, and we don't have to be affected by the circumstances around us. We have power because we can make our own decisions and decide our own future. And we have wisdom. We can see from a very detached attitude the whole world going around. If we can develop some understanding of the soul as our very center and operate on that with that ability, then we can solve a lot of problems in life. So if we have low sense of security, we feel helpless. If we have high sense of security, we're confident to face the world in any circumstance. If we have low sense of guidance, we depend on others to decide for us. If we have high sense of guidance, then we can make our own decisions internally. If we have low sense of wisdom, we have a distorted vision of the world. We don't see things as they are truly. If we have a high sense of wisdom, we have an accurate vision of what's happening in this world. If we have a low sense of power, we don't do anything. We let other people do. If we have a high sense of power, we create our goals and we create our future. So we set our goals, and then the mind can help us achieve the goals. So if you want to achieve anything, physically speaking, then it starts out in the mind. If we have the mental creation of what we want first stuck in our mind, then it manifests later on in the material world. So it's a very simple principle, just as whatever you think of when you die, you attain. So you think of a dog, you become a dog. Think of a deer, become a deer. Right? Here the dog is thinking of bones, then he'll get bones, whatever to eat. So we want to achieve it, we have to think about it and concentrate on it in the mind. Then it becomes real. First there's the mental creation, then there's the physical reality behind it. So the mind is very useful in doing that. As I said, whatever state of one remembers when he quits his present body, he will attain that state in his next lifetime. So mind is very powerful to help us determine our goals. Unfortunately, most people can't do that. They cannot concentrate the mind on the goal. Their mind is flickering. They're distracted all the time. As he said, there was, 70,000 thoughts going in your mind all day long. So we can't concentrate properly. And, of course, Krishna says, possible, difficult to control the mind, possible by suitable practice and detachment. Detachment means we have to kind of keep away from things we know are going to distract us. So unfortunately, the modern world is full of distractions because that's the whole purpose of people. They want to distract your mind to make you buy things. It's a commercial thing. So your mind is constantly distracted in this modern world. Very, very difficult to survive. So we have to avoid these things as much as possible. And then we have to practice as well. So just to summarize, if we want to change things, change the self, change ourself, not other things. We start with our we have to start with the self or the Atma, and through that then we can start working on the body, the mind, intelligence, etc. Change is possible, but it's not easy. It takes effort. We have to practice. And so we have to daily drill the mind, daily do sadhana of some sort, daily develop our new goals and our new habits, etc. And we want to change things. It's easier to change ourselves than to change others. Normally we want to say, oh, you should change. Something wrong with you. But actually, something wrong with us. So we change ourselves. That's easier than trying to make someone else change. If we change ourselves, then we can influence another person to change. By becoming responsible for our decisions and action, we change ourselves and gain the power to create our future. So if we do get this power to make our own decisions properly, not just work by habit, and we focus on our goals, then we can decide our own future. We should choose our goals with intelligence and imagination, focus on it constantly. As I said, we of course have all these material goals. Ultimately, the goal should be spiritual. That's the very center of everything. Goals must include acting according to the eternal principles in which we live, values from the soul. So that's the most important thing. Some things we can't change, we just simply accept as the grace of God. And by changing ourselves, we can change others. And strive for mutual benefit rather than gain, personal gain, at others' expense. So, to summarize again, a law of attraction. Whatever is in the mind, this becomes the reality in your life. So we have to very, very carefully filter what's going on in our mind, because that's what's going to happen in your life itself. And the law of karma, responsibility. If we do violent actions, we will get violence on ourselves. Law of responsibility. If we choose properly, then we get free from the law of karma. The law of change. If we change ourselves, then we can change the world. If we don't change ourselves, nothing's going to happen to this world. So everybody wants a better world, but we have to change ourselves first. Law of choice, we have to choose very properly. So there's a very good principle here. Is it good for your body? Physical, very basic. If it's going to harm your body, don't do it. Sensible, isn't it? But unfortunately, people don't follow that even. So we see cigarette ad, this is injurious for your health. But then people are buying the cigarette anyway. Foolish. So health, physical, whatever's bad for your health, don't do it. Happiness, a little higher mental state, what's going to create happiness and peace of mind, better. And if it's not going to do that, don't do it. another level. Is it right or wrong? Is it truth or is it lying? If it's truthful, do it. If it's not truthful, don't do it. Another level, very subtle. Beauty. If it creates beauty in the world, do it. If it creates ugliness in the world, don't do it. And, of course, the most important of all, unconditional love. This is the spiritual level. If the action encourages unconditional love, do it. If it doesn't, don't do it. Huh? So any action should say, yes, 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 five things, all positive. And if one is wrong, don't do it. Yeah. Okay, is that it? Yeah. Okay, we finished. Fine. Mind should vanish. Ah. Yeah. See one explanation of that? Okay. So, in the yoga system, the whole goal is to stop the functions of the mind. And if we stop the functions of the mind, then the Atma can reveal itself. This is called samadhi. Because mind cannot reveal Atma. It can only stop its functions of thinking about things in this world and its identity in this world. And then Atma realizes itself. So in that sense, we stop the mind. What happens, of course, is ultimately through the yoga process, we destroy that subtle body with the mind, and we also destroy the gross body. And this is what we call liberation. You get free from birth and death. So when you die, then the Atma is free from subtle body, gross body, and consequently birth and death. So that's called mukti or moksha, liberation. So what is left is the Atma, and the quality of the Atma is it's conscious. So material mind and intelligence no longer function, but the Atma has consciousness, so it is aware of things. But that's different from the material intelligence belonging to the subtle body, which is material. This is a quality of the Atma itself, spiritual, that it has the ability to be conscious of things, to perceive things, and to do things on its own. So that we can say it's a different level of intelligence, spiritual mind operate at that point from the Atma. Can? What about consciousness?
Yeah, the expansion of consciousness and how it expands.
Expanding consciousness, okay. Yeah, so in this world we talk about consciousness. Now this consciousness ultimately is coming from the Atma, but it's filtered through this sukshma sarira. We have an identity called the ahankara in which we identify ourselves as this or that. And then we have the mind and with its desires, etc. And we have the intelligence there. So these are the things which we can say pollute the consciousness. So we have material consciousness in this world. We're conscious of things, etc. But it's all, we can say, contaminated by this subtle body. Yeah? So that is why the yoga process wants to stop all of this. And it's only when we stop this, then the soul has its realization of itself. Now our consciousness is, I think I'm the body, I think I'm this, or I identify with objects of these in the world, I think this is happiness, I think this is pain, etc. So all this is going on, consciousness filtered through the mind, which is incorrect. Huh? Ultimately, as Krishna says to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, none of this is useful, it's not you at all. You're not the body. You're not these objects in the world. You're not these emotions. You're not this identity. You're the Atma, which is eternal. But we don't realize that. Yeah? So the consciousness is, we can say, polluted at the present time. So we have to come to a stage where we have pure consciousness, Atma realizing its own nature.
There is a question from the live viewer. A question to Guruji. How to differentiate the suggestion, thoughts from mind and heart?
What was the first one?
How to differentiate the suggestion?
Whether the thoughts are from mind or from heart. Oh, whether the mind or heart or whatever. Oh, well, generally mind and heart, in Sanskrit at least, mind and heart are the same thing, and they're both considered material. But then again, the heart is often used for the soul, so it's a little confusing when you talk about heart and mind, if you're talking about heart meaning the soul and mind meaning the material thing, whatever like that. Anyway, the final, we could say the way is by the results. And if we have thoughts are coming from material mind, we will end up with negative results, ultimately. We'll get disturbance, lack of peace, and a lot of problems. And if it's coming from the soul, or we could say the heart, the spiritual heart, or whatever, then we'll end up with a nice, peaceful situation. So we can tell by the results, ultimately. It may take a little while to figure that out, but eventually we can see that we get different results from these two things. So the mind will cause, ultimately, agitation and activity in the material world, whereas something influencing us from the spiritual level will create peace for us. This is, of course, it's not explained in detail how these relate to the subtle body, whatever they're mentioned, Upanishads, etc. But we can say they're more or less equivalent. Of course, they're levels of consciousness, and the levels of consciousness are also, you see, related to the layers of the subtle body. We have the gross body, which is like the Annamaya consciousness. Then we have a little bit higher, the Pranamaya consciousness with the pranas, which are part of this. More subtle than gross material level. Then we get Manomaya Kosha, that means mental level, and then we get intellectual level, Jnana and Vijnana, and then we get Anandamaya Kosha, which is the ultimate one. This we can say it has to do with the Atma, the spiritual level. So we can go from the gross physical, ultimately through different levels up to the spiritual level. So these are like koshas, or coverings. And so we can say the different layers of the subtle body. And finally we get to the Atma. Yeah, or, of course, there's also another thing, that Atma is Supreme Lord also. Atma is Vishnu, or the Anandamaya Kosha is Vishnu himself.
Swami, thank you so much for your sharing knowledge. I have a question, with all due respect to your knowledge. We were talking about Lord Krishna saying, Arjuna, that we are not this body, we are not this mind, we are not this emotion, we are pure consciousness. That being said, why do we impart so much of importance to body, chakras, and mind is so powerful, and so on and so forth?
So body and mind and intelligence can be used. Ultimately, they're temporary things, but they can be useful for us. So they're useful for the yogi. He does asanas, and he controls the mind, etc., and stops the activities of the mind. So it's not that these things, though they're inferior, cannot be used. And they must be used because we do have a body and a mind at the present time, and we're stuck in this consciousness. So we can use these things, which are at now, we can say, an obstacle for us. We can use them in such a way that they get good results and help us realize Atma, our soul. So they have double function. So the mind can be used in a bad way, and it degrades us, or it can be used in a good way, and it can help us progress spiritually. So it has a dual function. It can be used positively or negatively. So it's material, nevertheless, but it can have a good function as well. Just as anything in this world, you can use it in a good way. You can use a gun in a good way or a bad way. You can use anything, money, in a good way or a bad way.
Excuse me. Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
You said material body. Well, one is physical and the middle is material. Another is self, Atma. In the material body, there are three things. That is intellect, and ego, and your another one,
mind.
Yeah. How to differentiate, or it's all interconnected, or how it is put in that?
Those three things? Yeah, like the ego and the mind and intelligence? Okay. Yeah. So the false ego or ahankara is your identity. I think I'm a body. Yeah? We are conscious. I'm the body. I wake up in the morning and think I'm a body and I brush my teeth and take a bath and do all sorts of, and I think of my job. So that's my identity. That's called ahankara. So it's a very, very subtle type of matter. And it's an identity. And then we have intelligence or buddhi. This is discriminating power. We can discriminate, this is white, this is black, this is like this, this is good, this is bad, or this is a scriptural direction, this is a law of the country, etc. That's a discriminatory ability, viveka. And then we have mind. Mind is full of our desires. I like this, I don't like this, this is good, this is bad, etc. And our emotions. That's where the mind functions. So we have three things. It's all part of this subtle body or sukshma sarir, but different functions are there.
Practical world, let's say a person gets angry on a person and he sins. He gets a satisfaction. The other side suffers. Or a cheater, once he cheats a person, he gains something on that, he satisfies it. The other man suffers.
Yeah.
But the other, so when there's a negative, there's an immediate result for either side. Whereas when someone is doing a good thing, he's helping someone, he doesn't get a return immediately. Things gets longer or lower when the return comes. In the practical world, what happens? The bad things gives an immediate result. And the good things will sit later on.
Well, so not always. Sometimes you do bad activity, you get immediately bad result also. It's not always you get good results. Sometimes you may get thrown in jail, sometimes, yeah, maybe take a few days, but you get thrown in jail or you get punished or whatever. But the law of karma is such that it extends over lifetimes. So we do a bad, sinful activity, violent activity now, we may get the effect next lifetime or next lifetime or next lifetime. So there's a time lapse there. And the same with the good effects. We do a charitable activity now, we'll get the good result, yeah, maybe next lifetime or next lifetime. Now, of course, beyond that, we get immediate results. I do bad activity and no one detects me and I enjoy the results. That may be previous karma coming that I get a good result and a good enjoyment this lifetime. So we're enjoying the good karma from previous lifetime now. But later on, we'll get the bad effect also. So, yeah.
Same thing can happen for a good one also,
yeah.
For the positive one.
Yeah, so we can do good results. We can get immediate good results also sometimes. Or we may get bad results also due to past sinful activities we're getting in this lifetime. Yeah, a mixture, usually it's a mixture.
One more question online. Which is more powerful, mind or intelligence, and why?
Well, intelligence is put higher on the scale because if used properly, it can give us guidance. In other words, with our intelligence, we hear things. When we hear that, then we can start following the instructions and we think it's going to be good, give us a good result, especially if it's authoritative as scripture, then we get nice results from that. We go to the scriptures like Bhagavad Gita, we get good knowledge through our intelligence. We follow it, we get good results. So in that sense, intelligence is higher. However, as I also said, generally the intelligence is under the control of the mind, and we use it in the opposite way. We have desires, and then we use the intelligence to fulfill those desires without using intelligence in a proper way. So in other words, as I said, we have weapons of mass destruction or whatever in the modern world. We're using our intelligence, but the intelligence is the slave of our mind, which is fearful of another country, so therefore we build up our massive weapons. So that's intelligence under the control of the mind. So intelligence can go either way. It can be the control, that's the good one, or it can be under the control of the mind, and that's where it becomes bad. It has very bad effects. So we have to put it in its proper position. But to do that, then we have to have the higher thing, which is the soul involved also. If we get a taste of spiritual life, then the soul can control the intelligence, intelligence can control the mind, and we can have the proper hierarchy of things, and we can be successful. So intelligence just by itself, very difficult for it to control the mind. If it has higher taste, spiritual taste, then it can start to control the mind.
Thank you.
Sorry, I have a question. I have two as per yoga, Yoga Sutra.
Yeah.
But in Bhagavad Gita,
Krishna says that you have to and then shows. You can take an up and down. And then look at it and then.
Yeah, so what's the question?
The first question is, in Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, violence and sticking to truthfulness is what is to be followed.
Yes. Yama and Niyama.
So violence and truthfulness, violence should be abstained and we have to stick to truthfulness. That is what is Yoga Sutras. But in Bhagavad Gita and in Mahabharata, the war is waged by Arjuna, who is reluctant to go into violence, but it is preached by Krishna to go and act and wage the war.
Yeah.
And second point is, in some of the instances in Mahabharata, the war is won by Pandavas in not the true way. Not the true way. Not following the truthfulness.
Mm-hmm.
That is my first question. So in what way this is a yogic practice by Arjuna?
Yeah, so this is a general principle, ahimsa, but then we find that, for instance, the king has to administer justice. And in justice, he may have to catch a criminal and put him in jail. Then we say, ah, he's violent. He's punishing the criminal. Is it right or wrong? If a person has killed another person, we have to punish the killer, the murderer. So the king's responsibility is to do that. He has to punish them. He has to commit violence. But then that violence is permissible. So ahimsa is a general principle. What it actually means is do not commit violence which is unjustified. In other words, if it's unnecessary, don't do the violence. If it's necessary for some purpose, according to the law of Dharma, etc., then it can be done. It's not called violence in that sense. So it's a general principle, but we have to see the details also. And the same with truthfulness, whatever, like that. Highest truth, obviously, is the scriptural truth. And everything has to follow after that.
I have one more question. The unattachment or detachment. Detachment to be followed as per Bhagavad Gita, what Krishna preaches. Now, being detached and also be able to love and live in the life, how to practice it?
To believe in what? Detached plus?
That is, we have to be detached in our actions, is what is preached.
Yes.
So, go to higher self.
Yeah.
And also, if we have to be detached, how we can be able to live our life in love?
Good question. Ultimately, the whole trend of spiritual life, Bhagavad Gita, and the Vedas, Upanishads, is to get out of the material world completely. So therefore we have sannyas and things like that glorified. However, though the idea is to become detached from everything in this material world, we have different processes. One is, of course, you renounce everything, which is difficult for most people. The other is the gradual process. So anybody in life can practice spiritual life like bhakti yoga. Krishna says this, any varna, any ashrama, any stage of life, you can practice bhakti. So it's a flexible process and it doesn't require complete renunciation. Nevertheless, the whole system set up in Dharma is that there should be some minimum attachment. So we have rules and regulations of Dharma. You can do this, don't do this. Do this, don't do this. That's a type of renunciation also. So even if you're living as a householder with a family and children, etc., there's rules to follow in Scripture. And this creates some sort of renunciation. So therefore, someone who follows those rules as a married person, he's also renounced in one sense, because he's following rules for that particular ashram, the grihastha ashram, or the family life. So it is a type of renunciation also. Ultimately, of course, if we become completely spiritual and we realize Atma or Supreme Lord, then we become very disinterested in material life. We may carry on material life out of matter of duty, because we have obligations to others, and we do it, but we're not attached to it. So we can practice detachment within this material life also. It may be a little disturbance, but we tolerate the situation.
Last question. question online, right? Go back.
Mm-hmm.
There's one question online. Let's finish.
If everything originates from Krishna, does not also evil originates from Krishna?
Oh, everything comes from Krishna. Well, yes, everything comes from me, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. That means the whole material world and the whole spiritual world emanate from Supreme Lord. So that's there. Now, where does evil come from? Evil actually arises from us, people in the material world. What the Lord does, he gives us freedom of choice, free will. And with that free will, we can do this activity or that activity. Some of those activities are called sinful, papa. That's what the evil is. So it's our choice, not the Supreme Lord's choice. Maybe his fault is he gives us free will. That's all. Once we have that free will, then it's our choice. So therefore, the responsibility for the evil is human being. He creates the evil or he destroys the evil. And the Lord helps us destroy the evil. And not, he doesn't encourage it. So therefore, he has a system of dharma, etc., to help us.
Two more questions.
Swamiji, whatever you have given this lecture, of everything mentioned in the heart, and there's also given by three masters. Thank you.
Well, the real lesson we should learn from karma is we should be we don't have to worry about which previous lifetime we had, etc., whatever. But we should realize that we're responsible for our present situation, and we're also responsible for our future situation. Don't blame another person. So therefore, to be responsible, we should choose our activities very properly and do the good activities, not the bad activities. And this will improve our situation this lifetime, next lifetime, next lifetime.